All right, welcome to At the Letters. It's Thursday, April 18th, 2024. The Blue Jays are 10-9. I'm Ben Nicholson-Smith, along with Arden Swelling, on this edition of the podcast produced by Christian Ryan and Nick Andrade. Arden, let's just start with the bullpen. Do you have any Blue Jays bullpen hot takes you want to get off your chest?
Not really. Did you expect that I would? I'm not no. A big hot take guy. Yeah.
No, I would not expect that you would. I would
expect Jimmy Garcia is good. Is that yes, that's not really Jimmy hot, right? No. Jimmy Garcia is good. Chad Green's fine when he's healthy. Nate Pearson throws hard. You know?
Yes. Optioned. I was wondering this the other day. A friend of mine texted me, and I don't know how to look this up, but I have to imagine that striking out the side, touching 100, and being optioned is like a unique set of circumstances in MLB history. I just can't imagine that's happened that many times, if any times. But now Nate Pearson has that on his resume.
I don't know that we have the power to even look that up. I wouldn't even know where to begin with that. But there's got to be somebody who it's obviously more prevalent now. Like, it's kind of funny how now, like, guys who are throwing 100 are getting optioned, whereas, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, if somebody threw 100, it was like, this is the one guy in the league who does this. But there's got to be somebody somewhere where, yeah, he struck out the side, but he also like walked four and hit a dude in that inning and got optioned the next day.
Right. Where Pearson, it was three up, three down. Like, he looked great. And then, okay, so we're recording this on Thursday, as I said. This is the off day between the Yankees series and the Padres series. And at least in this moment, a lot of the discourse around the Blue Jays is about the bullpen, because, and in particular, John Schneider's management of the bullpen. And I think there are a lot of ways that you could look at this from. I mean, to start, to kind of acknowledge off the top, like, obviously it didn't work on Wednesday against the New York Yankees when the Blue Jays took a 4-2 lead into the ninth inning and blew it. I mean, that is a painful loss. That's a game they should have won. It didn't work. Whatever it was they tried. But I think it's probably worth investigating a little bit closer just to see, like, was there a way that they could have, should have handled things going into that game, going into that inning, that would have put them in a better position? So as you looked at that series of events, were you first guessing it? When you look back on it, are you second guessing it? Where do you stand with how that loss unfolded?
No, I thought the management was pretty unremarkable. Like, it's pretty garden variety, honestly. Like, you look at it coming in, you know that he's not going to have Romano on the back-to-back. The Blue Jays told us that. You're pretty certain that they're not going to have Jimmy Garcia. He'd pitched three of the last four, and it's still relatively early in the season. So you rule those two out. We didn't know this at the time, but we know now that Chad Green wasn't available due to a shoulder issue. And that just became very clear as that game played out, when there were a few spots where he could have used Chad Green in, and he wasn't even getting out of his chair in the bullpen. So you're entering the final four innings of this game with five relievers. Gosman gives you five, and then they go to Trevor Richards for the sixth, and Richards is coming off of a 26 pitch outing on Tuesday, so he gives you 14 more, and that's pretty much all you're gonna get from him there. So you get your inning there, you extend Yenesis Cabrera to two innings, 29 pitches. That's not a comfortable thing for a manager to do, but that speaks to just how shorthanded John Schneider was. Nothing wrong there. You bring in Eric Swanson, who's been a tremendous high leverage reliever for several years now, and he's fresh off the IL, and you bring him into a spot that you would throw him into, like, without question at any point since he's been a Blue Jay, and he's struggling to command. Like, he doesn't have the stuff, or he has the stuff, honestly. Like, the velo was there, and I think that the splitter movement was fine. He just wasn't commanding those pitches. Like, he just wasn't getting the splitter to carry the zone the way he needed it to. And then you bring in Tim Mesa behind him and end up extending him a bit longer than you'd like to. At this point, you're down to Mesa and Francis in the bullpen, and Bowden Francis is your piggyback guy 2 days later behind Yariel Rodriguez. So you've got like a glass case around him that you only break in case of emergency. So just considering the circumstances, I don't see any issues at all with the deployment.
Yeah. Like, I think once you get to the point that you have, all right, you have essentially four relievers available, then looking at how that game unfolded, you got to trust these guys. I mean, they're the guys you have. And if you deem Swanson to be ready, then using him, I mean, it's not like you can necessarily wait around for a 7-run lead where it's the perfect situation to bring him in. and ease him in. So if you've decided that he's ready, then don't really have a problem, don't have actually any problem with him coming into the ninth to close out a game. Now, I do think that, like, I tend to look at this, even if you zoom out a little further and say, okay, maybe there is room to second guess the Blue Jays a little bit, because I guess, first of all, did they properly assess the readiness of Romano and Swanson? Swanson didn't really look like he was at his best. I mean, that's for sure. Neither did Romano the previous night. Some really good defense helped him out, and the Blue Jays were able to close out that win on Tuesday night. But I think it's a reasonable question of, you know, did they properly assess the readiness of these guys? And in the case of Jordan Romano, you look at a guy who is available one of 2 days, essentially, once he's activated Tuesday. When I'm looking at that now, because that leaves them shorthanded, if he's only going to be ready for one of those 2 days, and you know that as the Blue Jays, we didn't know that on, you know, as the Blue Jays were making that decision early Tuesday afternoon, but they end up deciding, okay, he's only going to be available for one. Is there a case at that point to say he's going to actually have one more rehab game at Buffalo, then join the team on Friday, and then that way you're not down to just the four relievers?
Well, you had a save situation on Tuesday, and so thankfully you did activate Jordan Romano because he saved that game for you after Jimmy Garcia pitched the eighth.
Right. I mean, I guess the thinking would be at that point you would have gone to another reliever. Maybe it's a Nate Pearson, right? Because you would have had other guys around.
But I feel like Chad Green probably wasn't available then as well, right? Who would have been their preferred candidate. And I understand everyone's come around on Nate Pearson, but we've seen a lot of those styles of outings for Nate and that type of leverage not go great in the past. Yep. So he's looked very good in his most recent outing that we saw at the big league level, but there's a much greater sample of things not going as well in leverage for him. So I think you have to weigh that as well.
100%. And this is where, like, you look at this like literally 1 week ago, and if you could have offered to Blue Jays fans or Blue Jays personnel, and you say, okay, you can have Swanson and Romano at 80% health, let's call it. They're not totally sharp, but they're basically physically ready to go. Or you can have Nate Pearson and Mitch White. I think most people would have said Nate Pearson and Mitch White. Now, Nate Pearson goes out since then, has an amazing outing. This is probably the highest that people have been on Nate Pearson in a couple years. And rightfully so. He's looking good. And, you know, Swanson and Romano don't look sharp. Now, going into that, we couldn't, from the outside, we couldn't necessarily have known how that was going to play out. I do think it's on the Blue Jays. Part of their job is to assess their own players and determine their own readiness. And so, you know, to me, it sort of looks like they rush Swanson and Romano back with the benefit of hindsight. And this is all, like, just as a disclaimer to the whole thing, bullpen management is incredibly easy in hindsight, and it's difficult. It's really difficult in the moment. So I acknowledge that. And every manager will make bullpen mistakes in the course of a season. I'm not even saying that bringing in Swanson was a mistake, but I do think that the Blue Jays maybe rush these guys. Maybe they rush Kevin Gausman too. Like, we want them, I think, generally, you want to see a team try to compete and push with a sense of urgency. You don't want to see a team get really lackadaisical and just wait and wait. But at the same time, there's a downside to pushing with that kind of urgency. And sometimes it might mean that you're too urgent and that you actually rush guys in, whether it's Gausman or Swanson or Romano, before they're actually fully sharp to a game-ready state.
Not often that the Blue Jays are being criticized for bringing players back too quickly.
Right? But I think that's kind of what's happening here.
It's typically the opposite of that when it comes to the criticism of this team and its high performance department, right? It's what, another off day? What?
Yep.
Like, it's what, he just came off the IL and he already needs a DH day? What are you doing? Like, this is a team that is traditionally very conservative when it comes to players coming back from injury. So just based off of that alone, and also based off of, like, conversations I had with Eric Swanson and Jordan Romano earlier this week before they were activated, I believe that those two pitchers and the Blue Jays as a club believe that they were ready to come back and had good reason to believe that they were ready to come back. Like, I understand what the velo and stuff looked like in the minors, and I spoke to both Swanson and Romano about that specifically. And from Romano, the answer was, yeah, I mean, it was super cold and I just had trouble getting going and it was a lot spottier than I'd like it to be. But, you know, I believe that in a big league environment, it's going to be different. And from with Swanson, it was, yeah, I was just kind of in spring training mode in those games. I was just trying to get a feel on the mound. I wasn't turning it up like as much as I would in the big leagues. Trust me, when I get into a big league environment, the velo will be there. And lo and behold, when Eric Swanson got into a big league environment, the velo was there. His fastball against the Yankees was 92 to 95, sat 94 in average on his fastball. That's Eric Swanson's fastball. His splitter, the stuff, the vertical break on his splitter was 28 to 35, an average of 33 inches of vertical break. His overall average last year, 32 inches. So splitter stuff, there. Fastball velo, there. Health, feeling good, bouncing back from their prior outings, there. So you've checked every box. The thing with Swanson against the Yankees was he wasn't commanding his pitches very well.
Right.
And if you aren't commanding your pitches very well against a lineup like the Yankees, Giancarlo Stanton is liable to hit one through a window in the, you know, left field bleachers. That happens. But there's no way to predict that he's not going to have that command going into that outing. I just think that he checked every box. He went out, didn't have his control of a very important pitch, and paid the price, just as a lot of relievers do at the big league level.
Yeah, I do think like the one spot I push back there a little is if he didn't have his command in AAA, and again, I wasn't, you know, sitting in the scout section in Buffalo when these guys were rehabbing, so I'm not saying that I could have predicted this, but it, you know, Romano certainly looking at the box score line, like he was walking guys. It didn't seem like he had his command. Certainly didn't seem like it was pinpoint to the point that it would be, you know, mid-season form. And Swanson, you know, his command we saw against the Yankees, definitely not mid-season form. We saw that with Gausman too, by the way, earlier against the Rockies just a few days ago. So it takes a while. Sometimes that's part of the reason that spring training is so long for pitchers. It's not just a matter of getting the velo ramped up, because we'll be there on March the 5th, Arden, and we'll see guys throwing 95 to 97 and the velo's there. So it's a lot of the time it's command, it's repeating deliveries, it's some of those finer points of pitching that take a little bit of time to really get that finessed. And it seems to me that, you know, that's the job of the Blue Jays internal decision makers to say, does this guy have enough command? Even if he has the velo, does he have enough command to work his way through the middle of the Yankees batting order?
Yeah, I think it was a bit of a leap of faith that command would be there in the big leagues and that those guys were pitching at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a random Saturday in Buffalo where it was like 10 degrees Celsius. And I think the belief was like, hey, we're going to put our faith in one of the best closers in baseball of the last like 3+ years and a guy who threw 65 plus like really solid high leverage innings for us last year and ran a pretty low walk rate and a super high strikeout rate. Like, I just think that the Blue Jays like put their faith in what their pitchers were telling them and, you know, what they saw like objectively from how those guys were recovering between outings, which is huge, and trusted that their really good relievers were going to be really good at the big league level.
Yeah. And end of the day, like, just to be clear on this, you know, to zoom out, I mean, a little bit bigger picture before we move on to some other topics here. But, you know, I don't see an egregious error here. I think that when I look at this, I see areas where, okay, this is interesting. The Blue Jays seem to be comfortable, or maybe not comfortable, but they seem to be rushing guys back a little bit. They seem to be veering on the side of, let's get them back. Let's test them in the majors. Let's have that final hurdle be cleared in the majors for some of their top pitchers that they trust. So that's interesting to me. I think in this case, it backfired. I don't see that as like a colossal misreading of the situation. Swanson and Romano probably will have their command back within another couple outings and things will be back to normal. But it certainly didn't work on Wednesday.
Isn't that what people want to see? Like, don't people want to see urgency from this team? Like, don't they want to see the Blue Jays putting everything into winning these early season interdivisional games, like as much as possible, understanding that like the Blue Jays aren't going to run away with this division and the Blue Jays aren't going to make the postseason with like a 6-7-8 game buffer. Like, this is likely to be very close down to the wire. And we know how important these games are. Like, I feel like general observer of this team would want the Blue Jays to be urgent. I would want them to be making moves that are funneling as much talent to the big league roster as possible to give them as good of a chance of winning every night as possible, unless you are the type of person who a year ago, 2 years ago, at other times in the last few seasons of the Blue Jays tenure here have been saying, no, caution, we want prudence, take more time. Like, I just don't think that we've heard too much of that.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, normally you'll see fans who want to spend or want to promote the prospect, and it's often the front office that's, maybe we don't want to spend $120 million over 6 years for Cody Bellinger, or maybe Ricky Tiedemann isn't actually ready for the major leagues today. Maybe that's in the future that will happen. Maybe. In Tiedemann's case, it will happen. But yeah, I think that fans want urgency, but fans want wins too. And fans wanted a sweep, and I understand that. I think that you're facing the Yankees. That is a game you should win. You take a 2-run lead into the ninth inning. You hand it to a good reliever. Yes, you should win that game. And to see Tim Mayza and Eric Swanson cough it up, I mean, yeah, that's a tough one. It's a tough one. I understand any fan who's frustrated.
You want wins. You got 6 out of 9 games on the homestand. So that's like a 667 winning percentage. You do that over the course of a season, you win like 107 games, 108 games, something like that. Have a pretty good season if you keep doing what the Blue Jays just did over the last week and a half.
They are now on an 85 win pace. So they're going to have to.
That doesn't sound as good as the picture I just painted, Ben.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to zoom out here. They're 80 on a pace to go 85. And what would that be? 85 and 77. So, you know,
not
going to
be good enough. Not going to be good enough.
But also fine. Like, it's been a fine start to the season.
That's a good way to miss the postseason by a game or two. Winning 85.
Well, exactly. And ultimately, as we say this all the time, it's a results business, right? So if the Blue Jays keep doing this and their moves keep backfiring, well, there'll be a lot of happy fans, because eventually some people within this organization will have to pay for you know, if it doesn't go well. But sometimes those gambles will pay off, and sometimes the Blue Jays will end up sweeping series, and you know, the tone will shift a little bit. But as long as we're talking pitching here, let's also discuss Yuriel Rodriguez. You were down there on Saturday when he made his major league debut pitching against the Rockies, and it was an interesting outing. So I'll turn it over to you to just kind of hear your thoughts on what he looked like and what that means into his second start, which will be Friday.
And he got him. Strike 3 called on the inside corner for out number 2. Handshakes, pats on the back from all of his new teammates. Welcome to the big leagues, Yuriel Rodriguez.
Well, like, the first thing I want to say is that, like, no matter how that outing went for Yuriel Rodriguez, it was just impressive that he even made it to this point. Like, something that's been just a little bit under discussed, I think, and Shai wrote a great piece during spring about this process for Yuriel, is just what it means to defect from Cuba. And what it means to, like, leave your family behind and to go through, a pretty extensive limbo period, as he did last year, away from his family, still technically under contract to the Chunichi Dragons, but obviously not ever going back to Japan again, maybe as a tourist sometime later in his life, but not as a professional pitcher ever again. And just kind of being just in this weird limbo, waiting for his contractual situation to be sorted out and waiting to reach free agency and not making any money at that point. And as I said, being away from his wife and his young son. So, like, that's difficult. Like, he went through a lot to get to this point where he's now in North America pitching on a big league mound and having success. So I think that's why you saw, like, a lot of the emotion that you did from him during that outing. Like, I know he can be, like, a rather stoic dude, and but I think that after some of his outs and his strikeouts, his results in that game, you saw him pumping his fist and showing the emotion a little bit. And he told us after the outing as well that it was an extremely emotional day for him in more ways than one. So just kudos to him for getting here. The stuff speaks for itself. Like, obviously, the fastball is going to play in the mid-90s, sometimes reaching to the high 90s as well. Some interesting cut on the four seamer. He's got that two seamer as well. You know, he's messing around with his arm slots to get his fastball to play differently to different hitters, and you know, righties and lefties. That's interesting. And the slider is just filthy. Like, there is, you know, there's the building blocks of a really good high leverage reliever are here. Like, a guy who could just come in and air it out for an inning, maybe even two, and be like a real like right-handed Cuban Andrew Miller-esque weapon out of the bullpen.
Yeah,
that's
there's
there,
across the
right?
board comp.
Right, yeah, that's it rolls right off the tongue. Yeah, but exactly. It's like that is there. To me, that's almost the floor here. I think the Blue Jays are just chasing and going to continue to chase the ceiling of him being a starter and being someone who can give you like 150 innings a season. We'll see if they're able to get there. But, you know, the stuff is certainly impressive. And I think that there is, you know, certainly a bright big league future in some role, in some fashion here for Rodriguez.
Yeah, which is why he got $32 million guaranteed. That stuff is real. He's got couple fastballs, he's got the slider, curve, cutter. There's a lot going on there, and it can get swing and miss in the big leagues, so that's exciting for the Jays. And at this point, I mean, it's kind of funny how it plays out, right? Because they never made an announcement that like, yep, he's going to be in the rotation, Badwin Francis is out, but they just really kind of slow played it. They're like, yeah, we're working through some things, might be a piggyback situation. You know, Badwin Francis still walks out to the mound with the other starting pitcher, so you know, he's sort of nominally part of that group, but at the same time, he's available in long relief, as we saw on Wednesday. So Yariel Rodriguez is a guy that, you know, not only does he have upside for the future, but they sort of need him right now. And we'll see how long that lasts. Alek Manoah continues to work at AAA. He was throwing strikes in his AAA appearance recently, which is a step forward compared to where we were last week, but the results weren't great. So I think, you know, you want to see more from Alek Manoah, certainly, before he is really knocking on the door. And in the meantime, that creates an opportunity for Rodriguez. And I think, hey, as a fifth starter who can maybe give you four innings every 5 days, I think that that can work for the time being.
The interesting thing with Rodriguez is I don't think that you're ever going to see him throw 100 pitches in an outing this year. The Blue Jays are very cognizant of the limited bullets that they're working with here, and the fact that this is a guy who will probably max out somewhere around 100, 120 innings this year, just considering what 2023 looked for him, looked like for him, as he didn't pitch competitively after the WBC and just didn't have that like solid base of innings to build upon going into this year. So like the Blue Jays are going to want to be just very mindful of how they deploy him this year. So I don't know that he's like a true starter in the sense that you're going to see him completing five or six innings too often. Like, he's going to have to be very pitch efficient to do that. And, you know, one thing that I kind of wonder going forward is whether the Blue Jays, just for now, kind of take away a little bit of the hesitation, a little bit of the like switching arm slots during an outing, just to maximize his precision with his command and just to maximize strike throwing. Like, if he has a more consistent delivery, if he's more repeatable, he will be in the zone more often. And there's a lot of pressure on Yariel Rodriguez to be in the zone and to throw strikes right now, because if he walks two or three early in a game and his pitch count gets up to like 50 after two innings, I mean, it's just going to be a short outing for him, because he's just not somebody who is ever going to be like stretched out to the extent that Chris Bassitt is. And he's somebody who's going to have an innings cap this year. So, you know, it's like, it's interesting. You can't just throw stuff over the heart of the plate. And I think that that actually was a bit of an issue for him his second trip through against the Rockies. Like, this is clearly a guy who trusts his stuff, but I think the Rockies missed a lot of hittable pitches their second time through against Rodriguez. And I think he'll probably pay for that a bit against better lineups if he's leaving some of the sliders in similar locations to where he left them against the Rockies ultimately is going to be more effective if he is just like working more consistently to the edges like Jose Berríos has been really effectively this year. I don't know that you're going to be able to like outstuff a better lineup than the Rockies was that day. So it's just going to be interesting to see just how his delivery kind of evolves over the course of the year and how he kind of looks in his fifth outing, his 10th outing, his 15th outing, as you know, Pete Walker, the Blue Jays pitching folks continue to like work with him on just refining things and the way that he does stuff on the mound. You don't want to take everything away from him, right? Like you don't want to throw too much at him and kind of get him out of his comfort zone. But when I look at the hesitation in the delivery and the changing of arm slots, I think of, you know, what Yusei Kikuchi looked like a couple of years ago. And we've all seen the odyssey that he's been on with refining his delivery. I wouldn't be surprised if the Blue Jays do some similar things with the Ariel Rodriguez.
Yeah. Well, with Kikuchi, I mean, the results are incredible. I mean, you couldn't ask for any more. But on Yariel Rodriguez, even knowing, you know, the journey that Kikuchi's taken, I don't want to see the Blue Jays take anything away, partly just because, you know, selfishly as an observer of the game, I like it when things are different. Yeah, it's really fun, right? You know, we don't need everyone to be this like regular righty who throws, you know, with the same exact arm slot. And, you know, maybe there are strategic reasons for moving toward a little bit more consistency. But as a fan of the game, like I've always liked watching Marcus Stroman or Johnny Cueto or, you know, these pitchers, Nestor Cortes, of course, who's probably the best at that right now in baseball. I think it's really fun. And I think it can be effective at keeping hitters off balance. And especially for guys who are maybe a little bit more crafty, maybe sitting 91, 92. That's certainly not Rodriguez. Like, you don't tend to see, you know, the guys who throw upper 90s toward 100 doing those weird things because they don't have to. You're going to be off balance from the jump if someone's throwing upper 90s. So, you know, we'll see. But I hope he holds on to it.
That's the thing, like with a Stroman, like on a pure stuff level, it is somewhat underwhelming just compared to like the general standard of stuff in MLB these days. Like this is somebody who's trying to pitch to soft contact, trying to move it around, trying to get ground balls. Nestor Cortes, his fastball is like 91, right? Like he doesn't have an overpowering breaking weapon. So like those are guys who have to do stuff like that. Yariel Rodriguez is like mid-90s with an absolutely disgusting slider that is, as soon as he throws enough of them to qualify for these leaderboards, is going to be like one of the spinniest sliders in baseball. Like he's got spin rates like bordering on 3,000 on his slider. Like that is, there are, you know, maybe five dudes in the league who can do better than that. Like this is a like potentially truly dominant breaking weapon and a fastball that as a starter was like 95-96. I think we saw him touch 97 at times. That's why I'm just like, I can't get my brain out of him being this like two inning leverage reliever who comes in and airs it out and is up to like maybe even 99 in shorter stints with that slider. And then like just enough split fingers. I don't know if he calls it a changeup or a splitter or whatever he wants to call it. Just enough of those for lefties. I just can't get my brain off of him being that kind of weapon. And I bet you that towards the end of this season, that's actually how we see him being used as the Blue Jays manage the workload towards the back half of 2024 and try to keep him available as they go into the postseason. So like, I agree with you. I love seeing the hesitation. I love seeing the Japanese influence and the Cuban influence in his delivery. Like it's wicked. It's different. It's awesome. I love it. But I also know that the Blue Jays really value durability and really value strike throwing. And like a good way to either get injured or be really spotty with the strike zone is to be constantly changing your delivery and your arm slots and doing weird, funky stuff on the mound that your body isn't used to and that isn't repeatable and isn't a reliable way to throw strikes without putting too much toll on, you know, the many joints and, you know, ligaments and limbs that are involved in pitching.
Well, not that he's asking for my advice as a podcast pitching coach, but I would say hold on to all the hesitation and all the wild stuff. Keep it going, Yariel. Let's see more of that. It's fun to watch. But it is funny because, you know, he has this great stuff and, you know, and yet stuff is only part of it. And, you know, we saw Stroman here on Wednesday. He gets by. He does more than get by. He pitches really well because he locates so well and he fields his position. He does these different things. Same with Chris Bassett, who, you know, was great against the Yankees this week, despite the fact that he doesn't necessarily overpower people, but he's able to just keep hitters off balance so well. And that's against the Yankees team that, you know, keep in mind, we talked about this with the Rays and the Astros, but one of the reasons the Yankees are so good, I mean, you could put Aaron Judge on the Rockies or the Royals or the anyone, and he'd be a fearsome power hitter. But one of the reasons that the Yankees are so good is their game planning is elite. They're really, really good at giving their pitchers a really good idea how to keep opposing hitters off balance. And they're really, really good at giving their hitters a good idea of what is likely to be coming in across the plate at a given moment. And that's a tough thing to do, and it is equal parts art and science. But, you know, I think that to the extent that that's a science, I think the Yankees have it down.
They have a really formidable team of analysts and scouts and people who are just crushing video, looking for your tendencies, looking at your pitch usage, obviously, looking for any little thing in what you're doing on the mound that can give their hitters an advantage. Like, they are one of the best teams in baseball at finding those elements and then helping their hitters weaponize them. You mentioned Bassett, like one of the, it's been rattling around in my head ever since his outing on Monday, I guess it was. And this, I think, speaks well to like what we're talking about here, how prepared Yankees hitters are and like just how seldom you see them like truly bamboozled. There was a plate appearance with Aaron Judge, who the Blue Jays did a tremendous job with all week, by the way. Like, they really did a great job of containing Judge in the series. But there was one with Bassett on Monday where like he strikes out Aaron Judge cold third strike with a sinker that like could not have caught more plate.
It strikes him out. Gets Judge for the second time tonight. What a big out that is.
And to me, that's just the most impressive thing, because like this plate appearance went, I think he stole a strike first pitch curveball, right? Like drops in the breaking ball for a first pitch strike. And then he kind of like missed off the edge with a couple. And I think he got Judge to chase a slider or something, but he'd thrown him like four different pitches in four different spots. It was 2-2. And Judge just did not know what was coming. And I think that that is evidenced by the fact that he took a sinker right over the plate for called strike three. I mean, getting one of the best hitters in the game to watch the pitch he ought to be looking for. Like, if you're facing Chris Bassett, the pitch he throws most often is his sinker. The pitch he gives up the most damage on is his sinker. As a hitter, you're always looking for a fastball. That's always what you're looking to hit. Aaron Judge would have spent his afternoon hitting off the trajectory, the eye pitch, or whatever they use, the Yankees, against Chris Bassett sinkers. He gets one all over the plate, and he just watches it and takes it for a called third strike. Like, that to me, like, that is badass, man. Like, that is as impressive a piece of pitching, I think, that you're ever going to see, is Chris Bassett. Like, more, that's more impressive to me, honestly, than like the crazy Pete Fairbanks breaking ball that somebody, you know, waves at that goes strike to ball. I think it's so impressive that Chris Bassett dropped in what was probably like a 92, 93 mile per hour sinker all over the plate to Aaron Judge, and he just looked at it and walked back to the dugout.
It is. It's, yeah, it's so impressive. I mean, the Jays, honestly, you look at their rotation, there's been a lot to like about this group so far. And, you know, especially that you have Yariel Rodriguez in there in place of Bowden Francis. Kevin Gausman looks to be on track. You've got Barrios just dealing, looking like an ace at the top of that rotation. Kikuchi looks incredible, attacking, pitching the way that, you know, even going back a couple of years, you look at his stuff, you're like, why isn't this guy doing more with the stuff he has? Well, now we know what it would look like if he was doing more with the stuff he has. And it looks great. And, you know, you never know. And we all knew that last year there was going to be some regression. I'm sure there will be, you know, points in this season where some of those guys struggle. But man, right now, that front four looks really good. The Jays should be really pleased with how that group looks.
Yeah, ace-like behavior from Jose Berríos to this point. He's doing such a good job of just working to the edges, throwing sinkers to both sides of the plate against both sides of the platoon. He's really changed what he does against lefties effectively. Like, he's just not throwing them that four-seamer anymore, and like lefties just crushed Berríos' four-seamer the last couple of years. So he's really just lessened his use of that, replaced it with some cutters, upped the sinker usage against them. The slurve is playing really well, obviously. I still think that he's going to need to strike out some more hitters going forward if he's going to maintain this level of production or something close to it. It's probably not going to, honestly. I think he's got like a 105 ERA, so unless he's going to have like the greatest season we've ever seen from a pitcher ever, there's going to be a bit of regression to the mean here. But I think that correction could be somewhat significant if Jose Berríos isn't going to start getting more strikeouts, because like just bad things happen when the ball is in play. But yeah, he's been phenomenal. And then Yusei Kikuchi with that curveball that he started throwing kind of in May of last year, he still didn't quite trust it last April, came into last spring trying to learn a sweeper, didn't work. David Howell was like, hey, why don't you like switch up the grip and the arm angle and throw it as a curveball? And he kind of developed it and designed it and learned it a bit over April, started using it in May last year. And that's really where this run started for Kikuchi. Like, he's been really good since like late May last year, early June through till now, like super consistent and reliable and throwing that curveball a ton. It has been so effective for him. It's been one of the best curveballs in the majors this year. I think it's third in run value across baseball this year behind Drew Smyly and somebody whose name is escaping me. And he's also just keeping his pitches down towards the bottom of the zone as well. Like, he is just locating down so much. It's why Kikuchi's ground ball rate is like over 50% this year, because he's just been down with everything, you know, mixing those fastballs up, which is huge. That's why he gets a ton of swing and miss on the heater, because he's going down with that curveball. Zach Gallen was the other guy who had a great curveball this year. Kikuchi's right up there with those guys. Down with the curveball, up with 97, 98 from the left side, getting a ton of swing and miss at the fastball. I mean, that's just a really good recipe for success. So if you're the Blue Jays, just considering Kevin Gausman's start to the year, Chris Bassett's as well, and you know, missing Alek Manoah, getting what you're getting from Berríos and Kikuchi to this point has honestly been indispensable.
Yusei Kikuchi last calendar year, 3.4 WAR, 174 innings, 9.98 strikeouts per nine, 2.74 walks per nine, 3.57 ERA. So that is, I mean, that's elite production. That's great production from Yusei Kikuchi over the course of a full year. Arden, any last pitching thoughts before we take a break here?
Can I touch on Manoah quickly?
Yeah.
You mentioned him just like very briefly, kind of in passing when we were talking about Yariel Rodriguez. Like, to you, do you think that right now Alek Manoah is pitching to prove health, or is he pitching to prove performance? Like, which of those two do you think is all right?
I think it's performance. That, right, like, what do you think?
That is clear. I think right now it's both. Like, he's still kind of getting stretched out, but I think that this weekend start is where it turns to performance. Because I think to this point, like, you give him that first Dunedin outing, like his first outing of the year, I think he can put results aside there. He goes to Buffalo. He was better, obviously. Like, he wasn't Alek Manoah Cy Young finalist, but also we kind of have to adjust the expectations for Alek Manoah right now. Like, if he goes out in his next outing and he goes like five innings, eight hits, four runs, I don't necessarily think that's a bad outcome. Like, I think that's just what a reasonable expectation should be of Alek Manoah right now. Like, I think that if he is a fifth starter for the Blue Jays, I think they're pretty happy about that. You kind of have to, I know he was a Cy Young finalist, but like, that was a long time ago. And what we've seen from him recently has very much not been that. So if he can be a guy who like is capable of five and diving with like a little bit north of a league average ERA, I think the Blue Jays are honestly fine with that out of him, considering everything he's been through. So I'll give him that Buffalo outing because it was super cold and he did make strides. He was throwing more strikes than balls. He was in the zone more, and the velo's there and the bite on the slider is there more often than not as consistently as it needs to be, but more often than not. Be very interested to see this weekend's outing and just how it looks, because I do think this is where it turns from, all right, getting stretched out, getting used to the mound again, proven health, going through the spring training progression, to, okay, now let's actually see where the performance is and how you can help us at the big league level.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, ultimately, there's, with pitching, things change so fast. And so the idea that he was a Cy Young finalist a couple of years ago, great. That's a really cool thing for his resume. As far as projecting him into the next month, it's really, where is he at health-wise? Where is he at with his delivery? Where is he at with his stuff? What kind of stuff is leaving his hand? Because that will determine what hitters do with it and how hitters respond to it at the major league level. So, you know, we're seeing that he can put it over the plate. That's a sign that his health is trending in the right direction. We're seeing some of the data on the pitches that says that it's trending in the right direction. But, you know, as we've been talking about throughout this entire segment, which we're about to wrap, but he really does have to have some command too. And he has not had command at a high level in a long time. So that's something that I think the Blue Jays would want to see, would need to see, before they're really confident that he can get to the point of being an effective major league starter.
But I think if he gets back to the Blue Jays in like early May and goes the rest of the year, giving them like five innings each time out on average and like a 4.5 ERA, like if he's just like James Paxton, Red Sox vintage the rest of the way, 4.5 ERA, maybe they get 110, 120 innings out of him. I think that's a win. Like, I think that's good.
I think that's like a, almost like, you know, I was going to say a home run. That's not a home run, but it's like, that's like a double. That's like a good, like, that's like,
right.
You're, if you can snap your fingers and do that and you're the Jays, like, yep. Cause they already have their frontline starting pitching. You know, they don't need Alec Manoah to be an ace. They just need him to be a contributor. They're not at that point right now, but we'll see if they can get to that point. We will take a break here on At the Letters, step aside for a moment, but there is a lot of hitting to get to and more when we continue on At the Letters. Listen to At the Letters ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime. Welcome back to At the Letters. Thanks for sticking with us here in the early part of the season. Wherever you find us, thanks for the subscriptions, the likes, the downloads, the reviews. We appreciate all of that. And stick with us here. We'll be talking Blue Jays every week. And after discussing the pitching, I mean, it makes sense to turn now to the hitting. And you look at this group, and to me, Arden, I'm seeing a group that just lacks that home run swing. And sometimes these close losses that they've had, hey, if you hit three or four home runs in a game, all of a sudden you have a six-run lead, and it doesn't matter if Eric Swanson is maybe pitching at 75%. His command isn't pinpoint. Aaron Judge gets Tim Mesa for a extra base hit down the line. Whatever. You have a buffer. You still win that game. So at this point, we're looking at about a season's worth of plate appearances for this team, maybe a little more than a season. They have 615 at-bats collectively, 707 plate appearances as a team. They got an OPS of 688, which is actually slightly above league average. They only have 16 home runs. So, you know, that is a pretty middling home run total. That is a very unimpressive home run total. When you think about 707 plate appearances, it's not enough. They're going to need more home runs than that if they're going to get where they want to go.
Yeah, this is going to sound just absurdly reductive, but if the Blue Jays had better home run hitting ability up and down their lineup, they would be an absolute juggernaut. Like, they'd be one of the best teams in the league because they have a phenomenal starting rotation. Wednesday's game notwithstanding, they have a very strong and deep bullpen. They play tremendous defense, and they're doing everything but slugging well offensively. Like, when you look at some of the approach metrics, like some of those peripheral stats that we can look at this time of year that do tend to like stabilize very quickly, whether that's chase rate or swinging strike rate, the percentage of 3-0, 3-1 counts you see, walk rate, pitches per plate appearance, all this stuff, the Blue Jays are top five. Like, the Blue Jays have a top five approach MLB wide. The one thing they are lacking is the big swing. It's the extra base hits, it's the slugs, it's the home runs. As you said, Blue Jays bottom third in home runs across baseball, bottom third in isolated power, bottom third in slugging percentage, towards the bottom of the league in hard hit rate, average exit velo, barrel rate. Like they are just not taking advantage of the offensive opportunities that they are creating. Like this is why the Blue Jays have left as many runners on base as like nearly any team in the league. They're probably top five in the league in runners left on base. I would actually argue that that's a positive indicator. Like that's a good stat. You want to be towards the top of the league and runners left on base. That means you're getting a lot of runners on base and creating a lot of run scoring opportunities. The thing is, like the Blue Jays just aren't squaring up enough pitches in those opportunities to cash all these runners that they're putting on base. And I don't know, Ben, like you kind of look up and down this lineup. I don't know how much slug and home run and extra base hit upside there really is to tap into. I think the Blue Jays will be better going forward than they've been to this point, but I do think that their upside in terms of power is relatively limited.
Well, we'll see where it goes. I mean, we know that Vladdy has a ton of power. We know that Bo has more power than he's shown. To have Dalton Varsho hitting two home runs, well, we can discuss him more in a second here, but two homers, including one off a lefty, that's exactly what the Blue Jays wanted from him last year when they got the great defense, but not necessarily the power. This year, he's putting it all together. He looks like a guy who could appear toward the bottom of MVP ballots. I mean, he looks phenomenal.
So here's Dalton Varsho, and he gets one high in the air to right center field. It's gone!
So you got to be pleased with Dalton Varsho, but there haven't been a lot of positive offensive developments for this team. And, you know, I think that when you talk about, hey, they're doing a lot of things well, they're a tough out, and they're not putting the power together, no one really embodies that more than George Springer. And you said at the beginning of this season, look at Springer, Vlad, and Bo, because those are the guys who are going to hit the most, and they're going to take this offense where it goes. Well, that's so far been the case, and it so far hasn't been a great combination because those guys aren't really hitting a ton. And Springer's been okay. And it's funny, sometimes there's a disconnect here because you talk to players actually on the Blue Jays, and players on the Blue Jays this week, they're like really excited with what George Springer has done because he has had some really long plate appearances in the last, you know, week, 10 days. He is grinding at bats up there. He is making life difficult for other pitchers. And there's probably some tough to quantify aspect of that that is valuable. But at the same time, you know, you look at the isolated power for Springer. It has gone down each season he's been with the Blue Jays. From 291 in his first year here, now it's 110. Like, he is not hitting for power. His slugging percentage is 329. And I'm sure there's more there. But a lot of the time, his swing is, hey, I'm going to poke something through the right side, or I'm going to push something down the right field line and get a double and hustle and steal a base. And that's fine. Like, it's not like it's nothing. But this is not a 35 home run bat at this point in time. It's not a 30 home run bat. It's not a 25 home run bat. So, you know, that's not ideal if you're a Blue Jays team that's short on power.
I think what you're trying to say is George Springer has looked like a leadoff hitter.
Sort of.
Is that fair?
Yeah. And for a long time, George Springer was a leadoff hitter who looked like a cleanup hitter. And that was right. The version of George Springer that you really wanted hitting leadoff. And I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure there's a better option. So I'm not saying take him out of the leadoff spot, but it hasn't been a great offensive package.
Right. Like, that's not necessarily what the Blue Jays need from George Springer, even though he is their leadoff hitter. Like, he's always been such an unorthodox fit for that spot in the lineup. And I do think that his plate appearances have been superlative in terms of approach, in terms of what he's swinging at and what he's not. He's walking more often than he's striking out. His chase rate is second lowest on the team to Kevin Biggio's, and Kevin Biggio's going to run the lowest chase rate on the Blue Jays every year that he is a Blue Jay. So you will take the leadoff style plate appearances that you're getting from George Springer if he's there to be a leadoff style hitter. I just don't know that he is. I think he's there to be a bit more of a power threat and somebody who is slugging more often. And it's funny because through the first two games of the year, George Springer had two home runs. And it was like, okay, he's putting together the approach with the big swings. And he has like set himself off to have a very strong season atop this lineup. But since those first two games, he's played 17 since. He has only two more extra base hits, both of them doubles, the Blue Jays are just going to need more power from Springer atop the lineup.
Yeah, and it's early, and you know, I do think he will show more power than he has to this point, but his barrel rate is down in the early going. He's got three barrels. You know, he hasn't really reached those max EV levels that we've seen in previous seasons. He's not striking out, which is, that's great. But it is that a bit more of that contact approach. So, you know, we'll see what that overall picture looks like. They still need Springer. They still rely on him. He's still a really big part of this team. But you start kind of looking for where that power can come from. And obviously Vlad Jr. is the most logical place where it can come from if it's not going to be from George Springer. And I look at Vladdy and the way that teams pitch to him, and I still kind of have this feeling when you look at the numbers and you look at the data and the pitch charts that opposing teams are not finding that much difficulty in how they approach Vlad Jr. Now, he'll make you pay for a mistake. No question about that. He's got incredible power. But if you're a right-handed pitcher against Vlad Jr. and you locate your slider off the plate, he's often going to chase it. And so that remains a hole in his game at this point.
Did you see where Austin Wells was setting up during the Yankee series?
He was like next to Aaron Boone.
He's in the dugout. Like, he's setting up in the opposite batter's box, and Marcus Stroman is going ball to ball and getting chase out there. Yeah. You just don't see that every day, Ben. I mean, it's unclear to me why a right-handed pitcher would ever come anywhere close to in to Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Like, if he's going to be expanding like that, and if like the catcher behind him is going to set up that far off the plate and be able to get those kinds of swings. And it's the maddening thing about Vlad's last several years, right? Because we still regularly see him barreling baseballs. He had like a 116 mile per hour ground out the other day. You know, when this guy like miss hits balls, they come off of his bat at 112, 113 at exit velocities that hitters, when they hit a ball perfectly, cannot achieve. Like, good hitters cannot achieve that. So like, the talent, the potential, it's all obvious, and we've been talking about it for years. But you know, you are also just seeing him miss some hittable pitches. You are seeing him chase some shocking pitches. He's taking his walks, at least. I think you give him that. Like, it's just so inconsistent, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, because there are plate appearances where you're like, oh, he's like locked in here and he knows what he's looking for and he's making good swing decisions and like he's in a good spot. But then a plate appearance later, or two plate appearance later, it'll be, yeah, ball to ball slider way off the plate and he's chasing it. So I don't know how to solve that inconsistency. I just know that it's there.
Yeah, and we've seen that Vladdy is capable of being a great major league player. And right now, he looks like a very good one. And the contrast of expectations to where he is right now might lead to disappointment. Certainly when you pair that with the lack of success in the playoffs for this team, I think, you know, it's understandable that there's going to be somewhat of a disappointing feeling there. I do think it's worth giving him credit for his defense. Like, I think on Wednesday, that might be the best defensive game I've ever seen from Vladdy. Like, his arm was in action in a double play. He was able to feed Kevin Gausman on a really, really difficult play. There's another one that I'm missing off the top of my head here, but he was looking great defensively. And so that's something. But, you know, obviously when we're talking about Vlad Jr., we're not usually talking about the glove. We're usually talking about what he can do with his bat.
Yeah. And if you are not going to be getting power from George Springer, Bo Bichette, and Vladimir Guerrero Jr., three guys who have not been giving the Blue Jays a ton of power to this point, you're just not going to score a lot of runs with this lineup construction. You are going to be tooth and nail to go to the postseason. Like, you are going to need your pitching staff to be as elite as it was last year. You're going to need your defense to be as exceptional as it was last year. Otherwise, like, if the Blue Jays take a step back defensively or pitching wise, they're just not going to be a playoff team if they're not getting power from those top three hitters in the order. Like, that's just how thin the margin's going to be. And the thing is, every time Brios, a Bassett, a Gausman, a whoever is on the mound for the first six innings of the game, and every time a Swanson, a Romano, a Garcia, a Green is on the mound in the seventh, eighth, ninth inning,
they're going to be walking a tightrope. Like, they're going to have to be close to perfect. They're not going to have four-run leads, five-run leads to work with. They're not going to have cushion. They're not going to be able to exhale. They're going to have to execute with, like, extreme precision, and your defenders are going to have to make every single play because one ball drops in, one pitch is left out over the plate, runners are scoring, and that one run, two run lead that you've been trying to protect is gone, and you're losing the game.
You're saying the Blue Jays are not going to coast into the playoffs in this relaxing fashion, just, you know, cruising in, nice, comfortable lead, choose their own opponent. Just, you know, that'd be nice, right? But yeah,
well,
I don't think it's
going to let me know where out. Else. Let me know where else the power is coming from, right? Because if it's not from those three, okay, look, Justin Turner has been full value, right? Like, he's been tremendous. He's working fantastic plate appearances. He's hitting incredibly well with two strikes, among the league leaders in two strike hitting.
Twice he has been up with a runner at second, and twice he has cashed him in. Up the middle, another base hit. Justin Turner, three hits, three RBIs in this game.
But he doesn't appear like someone who in his age 39 season is going to hit for a ton of power.
No, I mean, if he hits 12 home runs, I mean, that'd be fine. Like, I don't think you're expecting even 18.
Exactly. So rule him out. Alejandro Kirk, I mean, has just shown zero pop this year. He isn't barreling anything. So until we see that power come back, I don't know that we can really look at him as much of a power threat.
And just on Kirk real quick, like, you know, we're talking about someone who has a great idea at the plate and is good at making contact. But if you're an opposing team, why would you ever pitch Kirk up in the zone? Like, just hammer him down in the zone, make him hit it on the ground, because once he starts running, you've got a lot of time to turn that into an out.
Sure. Kevin Kiermaier, swinging and missing a ton, not making particularly strong contact when he does put balls in play, not a huge power threat even at the best of times. So you put him aside. Dalton Varsho, sure, a guy who could maybe run into 25 this year. But as we've seen, like, he's going to be a pretty streaky hitter throughout. You just look at his first 20 games this year, 19 games, whatever it's been. The season opening road trip was miserable for him. The homestand was incredible. I think you're likely to see, like, peaks and valleys like that from him throughout the year. Like, I think you're likely to see him kind of trade really good and really bad stretches like that. I think Davis Schneider is a similar player where he's going to have really hot 10 to 12 game stretches. And then he's probably going to have like 12 to 15 game stretches where it's like 3 for 40 and he doesn't have an extra base hit. Like, I just think that those are the types of players that they are. Maybe they both finish with around 20, 25 homers. I mean, that's fine, but that's not going to be enough to replace what you need to be getting from the top three in your batting order. And then, like, you know, the rest of this roster, like Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, Kevin Biggio, Ernie Clement, etc., like, these just aren't guys who you're looking at as power threats. So really, right, it has to come from those top three if you're going to get these home runs.
Well, and yeah, because, you know, you look at where could reinforcements come from, and it's not like the Blue Jays have someone that's just, like, you know, on the brink, a top prospect who's on the brink of arriving in the majors and saving the season. Not that, which is, you know, Jackson Holliday obviously has had his struggles with Baltimore too, so there's danger even if you do have a legitimately top prospect. But in the Jays case, like Joey Votto, okay, he's, you know, seemingly still a good ways away from being able to contribute because he hasn't gotten into a minor league game. So that ankle has sidelined him now for a month and counting. Then you look at AAA, okay, Spencer Horwitz and Addison Barger are off to really good starts. They're probably the two hitters who would be closest to being called up. I know where all of us hit a grand slam in AAA just the other day.
Uh-oh. There's a deep drive to left field, and it is way out of here, up into the second level of the left field building. And that's a grand slam, and things just got
But
really
I think defensively, he's made a lot of errors. I'm just not sure that he's necessarily going to get that call. So, okay, Horwitz or Barger, but you're not going to count on those guys to turn your offense around. It really does have to come from your big stars. And this is where, you know, Vladdy, Bo, I'm not saying Bo has to be anything other than the hitter he's been for the last 3, 4, 5 years. And I fully believe that he'll get to that point. But in Vladdy's case, like, you do need stuff from him. And this is where there is pressure for both these guys in a way that maybe there hasn't been in years past.
And I think that with Martinez and Barger, like obviously it's early in the season. We'll see how it plays out. They've done very well to this point with ABS against AAA pitching. But like the Jackson Holliday example is a prescient one because Jackson Holliday was hitting better at AAA than either of those players are. And then he comes to the big leagues and, as you said, had like what, one hit in his first 21 plate appearances with like 14 punchies, something like that. So, you know, just like tearing it up at AAA, even as like the literal top prospect in the game, isn't a guarantee that you're just going to step into the big league level and continue to rake. You have to expect some sort of an adjustment process there.
Yeah. It's just a different league, right? Someone said recently, AAA is easy. It's the major leagues that are hard. And like, I think that's probably, you know, the numbers would bear that out. It's a much harder league.
Yes, absolutely. And I also don't think that like the Blue Jays should be trying to force things with their lineup construction either. Like Dalton Varsho hits a home run yesterday, and today you're facing a lefty who's a really bad matchup for him. I don't think that you're forcing him into the lineup just because he hit a home run yesterday. Like, I don't think that you need to fall for like the like obvious cause and effect fallacy of like being, oh, you hit a home run yesterday, you're hot, put him in there, force him in there at the expense of everything. Like, I think that guys like Varsho, Schneider, Clement have had the success in small samples that they have because they've been put into optimal positions where that play to their strengths. Like, they've been put into circumstances in which it is likely that they will succeed based on, or more likely than it would be in others, like based on, it's never likely you're going to succeed in the big leagues. It's actually likely that you're going to fail. I rescind that, but you know what I'm trying to say? Like, these are optimal conditions that play to their strengths, whether it's the matchup, the swing plane versus the opposition starter, the handedness, what have you. They're being put, like, their success is a product of the limited situations that they're being exposed to. You start exposing them to a wider net of situations, including ones that we know that they don't necessarily thrive in. And I think that you're going to see the numbers scale down from where they've been to this point. Like, to me, the Blue Jays have four everyday players: George Springer, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Bo Bichette, and Justin Turner. And then from there, there are like, you get your, you know, one of the two catchers, whoever it is. And then you've got six guys for the final four spots. And you're just like plugging in whoever are the top four matchups against that day's starter. And you're also considering, obviously, health, a little bit of performance, but also just as much, who do we want on the bench to match up with their bullpen late in the game? Like, just because Davis Schneider hit a home run yesterday and isn't in the lineup today doesn't mean that he isn't going to have a role to play in this game later in a matchup that plays to his strengths.
Right. Because it's like, you know, you oftentimes will use those players on the bench. The Blue Jays are not shy about using their bench. This is not the, you know, Cito Gasson era. We're just going to trot the same lineup out. And we got like four Hall of Famers in it, plus Devon White and John Olerud, who like are borderline Hall of Famers anyway. And then, you know, you're just going to have an amazing, consistent level of production. This is a lot more mix and match. I'm sure that the Blue Jays would love to be in a spot where they have six future Hall of Famers, not where they're at. So that means that there is a lot of creativity. Do you think there's any Hall of Famers on this?
I was just going to say,
yeah.
Is there one? I doubt it.
Hmm.
If Bo like has, you know, if he goes on to have like 3,000 hits, maybe.
Yeah, Bo has a non-zero chance.
It would be hard to deny him if he got to 3,000 hits. He's already at 668, and he is 26 years old. So
Vladdy obviously has a non-zero chance.
It'll be tough for Vlad, considering how the last couple of years have gone. Kiermaier, not even a chance. I don't know what you're talking about. Mount Rushmore center field defender, but just nowhere near the offensive standard to be in the Hall of Fame.
No,
Springer,
I agree.
Springer would have more of a case, right?
Yeah.
As a center Springer, fielder than no. Kiermaier.
No.
But no. So
Turner?
No.
No.
No. Not as a DH. I mean, third baseman, still not. Like Beltre, like he's not at that level. Votto, but he's technically a Blue Jay, right? Like,
yeah, but he's not on the 40 man, so I don't think Votto counts right now. So I would say this current roster does not have a Hall of Famer on it.
This is quite a digression.
Yeah. And where was I going with that? Mixing and matching. I would say, so the Blue Jays have four everyday players, to your point. I would toss Varsho into that right now just because he's such an elite defender that even if he's passable offensively, I think for him and for Kiermaier, if those guys are like 90 to 100 WRC plus players, then they kind of ascend toward that everyday level. And I think the way Varsho is swinging it now, I'm fine with him being mostly an everyday player. But look, if he's not in there on a certain day, I'm certainly not going to lose sleep. You know, I'm not going to have to, you know, hit snooze four times because I was up tossing and turning, you know, over the Dalton Varsho decision.
I don't know if I'm forcing Varsho in against lefties. The thing is, like, Kevin Kiermaier
someone's got a
tough start.
Yeah.
One of those two is playing, and yeah, Kiermaier's having a very tough start to the season.
Yeah, so I'm fine with that being Varsho.
If the case is one of these, like if this is the justification that one of these two guys is going to be your center fielder on the day and Varsho is just swinging it better than Kiermaier is right now, okay. If the justification is Dalton Varsho is the hottest hitter on the planet, he hit a home run yesterday, he's got to play today, I'm not here for that argument. But if the argument is he's a better option than Kiermaier, just considering how they're going right now, I will hear that if you are, you know, constrained to one of the two having to be in there. The thing that's impressive about Varsho right now is the swing decisions, honestly. Like, of course, like the power is great and, you know, home run off the lefty, first one since 2022. That's phenomenal. But to me, it's just, you look at his chase rate, you look at his swings and his takes, like he's just narrowed his zone. And that's just, when you look at the times when he has been playing well over the last few years, it has been when his chase rate is low. And right now his chase rate is as low as it's been since he joined the Blue Jays. So like that to me, like the swing decisions, what he swings at and what he doesn't, like how he manages the strike zone, that is like the secret sauce that underlies his success to me. That's when he gets to pitches that he can barrel and hit hard. And then it's just about like not being too steep through the zone, just keeping his bat path level so that he's not having as many pop-ups and he's hitting more line drives and barreling balls like he can.
One other thing that I think works for Varsho is being selectively aggressive and just going after some first pitches. And if it's 91 over the middle and he's ready and sees that pitch, go for it, swing at it and do some damage. So I think that's been working for him too. And honestly, they kind of need this, right? As we kind of go through some of these names, Danny Jansen, okay, there's a guy who's going to give you some power. And obviously he's just now returning from the injured list. But there aren't a ton of guys where you're fully, fully confident they're going to give you a ton of power on this roster. So Varsho is someone whose power can help give that lineup the balance that it needs and get them to at least average power, where you pair that with some other good offensive traits and you have yourself the makings of what can still be an above average offensive team.
Yeah, if Varsho can hit you 30, then you can start to make up for some of the homers that you are not getting from a Springer or a Vlad. But if he hits like 20 to 25 this year, to me, that's the expectation. Like that just should be just what he's capable of. That should be what you baked in to your win expectancy. I think that the surplus would be if, you know, his home run total started with a 3. We just haven't seen that yet. To me, like, I know it's just obvious, but it keeps coming back to Springer, Guerrero, Bichette. Like those are the guys that are going to carry you from a power perspective, just from an overall offensive run producing perspective. And I think that you're seeing guys like Bo and Vlad sort of show that in their plate appearances. Like they are taking some big swings, you know, like these are guys who are trying to leave the yard. Like these are guys who are trying to damage baseballs and impact them in a very loud way. Like you're not seeing as much of, you know, Bo Bichette with two strikes, just kind of like settling for a single and like flicking the ball the other way. Like you're seeing him try to do damage, because I think that with where he's at in lineup and how the rest of this Blue Jays offense is constructed, I'm sure that he, just like Vladdy, who has admitted this in the past, is feeling some pressure to produce and to put up runs for this team.
Yeah, and that's part of the challenge. And the great hitters find ways to navigate that pressure and produce nonetheless. So yeah, we will see where it leads for this team. Arden, any closing thoughts here on the offense or on anything else?
That's all I got. What about you?
That's it. We're tapped out here on At the Letters. You've heard all of our thoughts on this team as the Blue Jays head to San Diego into Kansas City. Arden and I will record an episode next week from Kansas City. So stick with us for that content. And in the meantime, enjoy the games. Stay tuned. Stay tuned to sportsnet.ca as well, where we'll have lots of writing. And thanks for listening to At the Letters, which is brought to you by Christian Ryan and Nick Andrade, our producers. For Arden Zwelling, I'm Ben Nicholson-Smith. Thank you so much for listening.